Hello, hello.
I'm Savannah.
And I'm Alicia.
And this is Burden Proof. Welcome back.
Welcome. Welcome back. Welcome, new listeners.
Hello, all of our new friends. Happy April 25th.
Happy.
I can't read our sign from this far away. We have, as you guys know, a whiteboard that has all of our dates and episode names. I think that's the 25th.
Yes.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed Amber Smith. We're back this week with our Patreon suggested case. This is Eileen Wuornos, everybody.
I'm ready.
If you think you don't know this case, but you've been in the true crime field, you do know this case. You've seen her at some point.
Even if you haven't watched the true crime documentaries and stuff about it, a lot of listeners around my age have probably seen the movie. I think it was called Monster.
It's called Monster.
With Charlize Theron.
Oh, you know how many times I saw that name while I was researching for this and did not know how to pronounce it?
Charlize Theron. I'm being fancy. I mean, most Americans just say Theron.
Yeah.
But I think technically she's South African, so.
Oh, okay. I did not watch the movie.
It's a good movie.
I have heard that it's good, but I've heard that it makes it look a little sexier than it was.
Definitely.
I didn't watch it.
I mean, and she did you know who she is, right? The actress, Charlize.
The name sounds so familiar. I know she's been in other things.
Oh, yeah. She's been in a lot. She's gorgeous.
Yeah.
But for this movie, she is not as gorgeous, but she's still like, you're like,
that's not
you
what
tried
I
tried to ugly yourself up. And
that's like when Margot Robbie's like, I'm not beautiful anymore. We're like, you're Margot Robbie. It's literally impossible.
That's kind of how I felt about this. I mean, they did a good job. It's a definite transformation, but I still felt like
I saw clips of it while I was watching a YouTube documentary. And yeah, she sounds a lot like Eileen. Especially like early days Eileen, not after prison, but before prison Eileen.
Yeah.
She sounds a lot like her.
She did an excellent job. But you can only make that level of beautiful, not beautiful.
Right.
And outside beautiful.
And Eileen Wuornos was not a looker.
No.
Not a looker.
No.
Well, I'm going to just warn y'all up front. This is a controversial case. A lot of people have a lot of feelings about it. I'm sure some of our listeners are going to be divided. That's okay. I'm very conflicted personally.
Yeah. I've always been on this case.
So we're going to talk about it. But just know that whatever opinion you have, that's okay.
Absolutely.
Unless it's like not related to this and you have like a weird opinion.
What?
I just feel like the phrase any opinion is okay is a little broad. So I was going to narrow it down a little. Some opinions are bad. Don't be racist. Cool.
Well, yeah. Or bigoted.
Yeah. Anyway, let's dive in. You ready?
I'm ready. All right. Buckled up.
A leap year baby on February 29th, 1956, Eileen Wuornos was born to a Finnish immigrant who had recently divorced her husband, and they already had a previous child. So Eileen was their second child.
Got it.
Okay. They had divorced before Eileen was born, which was probably a good thing, as we'll talk about in a little bit. But her older brother's name was Keith, and her and Keith would be super close, as we'll see. Unfortunately, her mother didn't stick around for long, and shortly after she was born, her mom abandoned both her and Keith and left them with their paternal grandparents. Her grandfather was named Lori, and her grandmother's name was Britta.
Britta.
Like the filter.
But I kind of like that name. If not for the filter, like, that's...
I agree.
A cute name.
Have you seen that trend of things that if they didn't mean what they were, they would be pretty names?
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. So, as you said, it was her paternal grandparents.
Yes.
And fortunately, her father's side of the family was seriously disturbed. Her father would eventually do time for child rape, and he would kill himself while incarcerated. Her grandfather was a whole other beast. He was known by Eileen's friends to brutally beat her, and we would later learn that he had started sexually abusing her as well. Another thing to note is that Eileen and Keith were not told that these were their grandparents for the first 10 years of their life, of Eileen's life. They were told that they were their biological parents until Eileen was 10.
Wow.
Strangely enough, this also happens to Ted Bundy.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah. They were told that their biological aunt and uncle were their siblings. And, you know, they thought they were all related until, like I said, she was 10 years old. They found out that they were adopted. And this would mark a big change, or at least the first time that Eileen really noticed that things were not fair at home. Her and Keith were treated way differently than the other children, and it's believed that this is sort of when the sexual abuse began, and the physical abuse definitely worsened after they found out they were adopted. It was like, okay, everything's out in the open. I can beat these kids. Like, he was really, really horrible.
Wow.
Trigger warning for animal cruelty here. Ugh. So just be, I'm sorry. I know. But, like, one thing that happened was that her grandfather forced her to watch as he drowned a kitten that she was told she was not allowed to keep. So that's the kind of
what the hell
crap we're dealing with. Right. So around when Eileen was 13, like I said, she didn't know her father, but that is the age, like, he committed suicide at this point in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And then she developed a really hair trigger temper. It was like all or nothing, 0 to 60 really quick. You know, it's hard when you're a kid.
I mean, this is one of those cases where, like, what she ends up doing is not excusable, but, like, you feel for that. You feel for the serial killer who grew up in this terrible way.
Right.
Like, not that it excuses what they go on to do, but that's awful.
It is. She was diagnosed with hearing and vision problems at a young age, which was hindering her education. But her grandparents, and especially her grandmother, was known to just tell her that, like, that's not actually causing your problems. You need to just pay attention. So even though Eileen had
Just pay attention. You probably have those problems because of genetics and or the fact that you're being abused. And, you know, throw that PTSD aside.
Right.
From all the abuse. And just pay attention. Just focus.
Just pay attention. I wrote in my notes, I was like, I'm sure many people with disabilities, especially in the 60s, were told to just focus.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case. And Eileen had a normal, or at least mostly normal, IQ level, but her language comprehension was very delayed. So even the way she talks as an adult is a lot like that of, like, a middle schooler, maybe like fifth grade, sixth grade level. So she has the brains behind it, but it's difficult to see that.
Yeah.
Okay. At 11, there are records of Eileen beginning to exchange sexual favors with her peers for cigarettes. I think this can easily be attributed to the alleged, although pretty obvious, sexual abuse that she suffered as a child. This earned her horrible nicknames, bullying, and a bad reputation. Obviously. And then when she was 14, she popped up pregnant. So even today, we don't know who the father was or what the circumstances around the pregnancy were. I personally believe that the child was a product of rape. And this is Eileen's first story, but that eventually shifted. She changed it later to say that it was not that way. She goes back and forth on that a lot. But the most likely and most believed stories by people who have studied Eileen's life is that, A, the child was fathered through the rape of Eileen by one of her grandfather's friends, or that, B, the local pedophile had raped Eileen and fathered the child because there was somebody in their community that the kids were, like, warned about, that they knew who he was, and Eileen had been seen near him recently. There are those two options. I think that it is unfortunately more likely that it was option A, that it was one of her grandfather's friends, because we do know that he passed her along to his friends, unfortunately.
I'm containing my rage. Sorry.
It's a very enraging situation.
This also doesn't help that I, this past week, saw a post on social media with a statistic that, like, 40% of teenage pregnancies, the father is between ages 20 and 29.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, this was her grandfather and her grandfather's friends.
Well, yeah, it's that's like even worse. But like,
the world is gross.
I have no words, just noises.
Yeah. This case was really tough to research, and I've been working on it for like a week and a half, almost 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So it's just been consuming my every thought, and yeah, it's a tough one. I don't think that it was consensual activity, despite the fact that Eileen was actively pursuing sexual favors with her peers. Some people are like, well, we don't know. She was already having sex. And no, you're right. But like,
but if she was underage and it was a grown man, doesn't matter.
Right. So she was sent to a home for unwed mothers where she was throughout her pregnancy and through her birth. She gave birth to a boy who was pretty immediately given up for adoption. Upon her return to her grandparents' house, she was told that she couldn't live there anymore, and they got into a huge fight, and she was kicked out, and Eileen began her drifter life. She continued to go to school for a little while, but she was living in the woods near her grandparents' house. She wasn't living at home.
So I just want to get this straight.
Yes.
We believe that she was, I'm going to use the word raped.
Right.
By her grandfather's friends, who then got her pregnant, and then after she gave birth, they then kick her out because now she's tainted.
I don't know if it was because she was tainted. I think they just didn't want to deal with her, and like her grandfather was just like, no, bye.
And she's 14.
Mm-hmm. And she's living in the woods near their house. Like, they see her regularly. Horrible.
Yeah. Oh. Okay.
The little wooded area near her grandparents' home had a little community of runaways. And sometimes the neighbors would allow them or her to sleep in their cars or abandoned cars, like when it was cold, because they were living in Michigan. So it was cold.
Yeah.
Shortly after her grandmother, Britta, passed away of cirrhosis of the liver, because spoiler alert, she was an alcoholic.
Shocking.
I know. Eileen did attend the funeral, but she was disrespectful and asked to leave. After her grandmother's death, she began hitchhiking south, and she headed down to Alligatorville, our reluctant state of Florida.
Sorry. Just wasn't expecting that.
You didn't know this was a Florida case?
No, I did. Oh. I just wasn't expecting that.
No. Was it the Alligatorville?
Yeah.
I liked Alligatorville.
The reluctant state? Is that what you called it?
Yeah, we are reluctant to live here. It's our reluctant state.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So she was a sex worker picking up Johns all along the way. And we're going to jump forward a few years and pick up with 20-year-old Eileen.
Okay.
Right? Time jump. In Central Florida, she meets 69-year-old Louis Grotzfell, the former president of the Florida Yacht Club. Why can't I say the Florida Yacht Club? It's a mouthful. He was quite wealthy, and the two got married.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't I remember this?
Because it only lasted for 9 weeks.
Oh, well, that. And it's been a long time since I've heard her story. So.
Yes. So, like I said, they got married. They were married for 9 weeks, and the marriage ended because of Eileen's affinity for going into bars, causing fights, and generally getting into trouble with the law. In addition to this, it is said that Eileen regularly abused him, beating him with his own cane. He filed for a restraining order, and she actually fled back to Michigan and had their marriage annulled. Around the same time, her brother Keith suddenly passed away from esophageal cancer, leaving Eileen a $10,000 life insurance policy. She used this to pay off a fine or a bond or something from one of her previous crimes, and she also used the other part of it to buy a car. She would eventually total that car while driving under the influence. And once the life insurance money ran out, she went back to Florida. This seems as good a time as any to let you know that she was not only committing the crime of prostitution. She was arrested in the mid-70s for assault, disturbing the peace, and disorderly conduct. In the early 80s, she served time for an armed robbery where she drunkenly tried to rob a convenience store in a bikini.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah. She also had a record of forged checks, resisting arrest, drunk driving. She had lots of aliases and fake names.
Mm-hmm.
she was a mess. She was a drifter. She was never homed. She was always flitting around. I don't know what I was trying to say.
I like it.
This time after she came back from her annulled marriage, Florida, things went a little bit differently. She got arrested for armed robbery, and she did some time before getting out and continuing to prostitute. Is prostitute a verb or a noun? Can I use the word prostitute as a verb? Continued to prostitute.
Sure.
It's not a verb.
It's not.
It is a noun. Okay, but you know,
we can start anew. You're Gen Z. You can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
This generation has come up with more fake terms than ever before.
First of all, slay is a real term. Slay.
Yeah. But you change words all the time.
Anyway, back to prostituting.
Okay.
Eventually, she met and fell in love with a motel maid, Tyria Moore. Some people say Tyria. Some people say Tyria. It's spelled Tyria.
Yeah.
But she went by Ty, so we're going to call her Ty.
Yes.
That's way easier.
Yeah.
Eileen tried her hardest to support Ty with her earnings. She tried to support her because Eileen, who was, like I said, now going by Lee, was very possessive and disliked when Ty was out working or with anybody that Eileen wasn't there or that she didn't know. So she thought, if I can support her, then she won't be with anybody I don't like. This eventually shifts from being the reason. So this is the reason at first that she's taking care of her, but later we'll see that Ty isn't completely innocent in all of this and was definitely telling Lee on a regular basis, like, I'm all you have and I'm going to leave if you don't pull your crap together. I'm going to leave if you don't get enough money. Like, she was always threatening to leave her. She was regularly saying, well, I'm all you've got. You don't have anybody else. It was definitely in a manipulative situation.
Yeah.
And so Lee felt really compelled to maintain what she was bringing in financially. Unfortunately, she was aging. And she was not aging well. And so...
No, most people don't when they've lived a drifter life since they were 14.
And she's doing lots of drugs, just copious amounts of drugs. And she's drinking very heavily to cope with everything that's going on. So her earnings were slowing down a little, to put it kindly. They moved around a lot, maintaining their drifter status, living in different motels, apartments, and mobile home communities in Daytona and other areas in Central Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It's also important to mention that Lee's life as a prostitute up until this point and continuing after her meeting Ty was very violent. She had been beaten and raped multiple times, and this was basically just a theme throughout her entire life. This was her normal, even if she didn't like it.
There are no words.
Yes. So Eileen and Ty had been trying to get out of the motel that they were living in, but they hadn't been able to come up with the funds for the apartment that they wanted. One day, Eileen was picked up by a man named Richard Mallory. Now, the true events of the day will never be known, but we will talk about theories and personal theories in a moment. Richard picked up Eileen with the intention of soliciting her for sex. However, according to Lee, she realized that he was about to get rough and about to rape her, and she reached into her bag, panicked, grabbed her gun, and began shooting him. She claims this was fully in self-defense, and personally for this one, I don't think she's lying, despite what she will say later.
Okay.
Richard Mallory had a record as a convicted rapist and was a predator, and he had done time for that. For him to have done jail time for it, it was really rough. It was a bad situation.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this actually wouldn't come out until after the trial, as it hadn't been allowed as evidence.
Interesting.
I say unfortunately. That's, but it's just a fact. It didn't come out until later, at least to the public. So this is a huge escalation from any of Eileen's crimes in the past to straight up shooting somebody. I genuinely think that he was going to hurt her. I do think that this one was in self-defense.
Yeah.
However, it would become the catalyst for 6 more deaths. She shot him several times in the chest, moved his body to a known illegal dumping ground in the woods, and headed back home to Ty. She had robbed him. She took out anything of value, and she went back home. At home, she told Ty straight up that she had killed a man that day. She said she'd shot and killed a man that day. Just moved on from that, I guess.
I mean, as crazy as it seems to those of us that live, you know, just a normal, boring old life.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, it's like a highlight in the week of theirs, probably.
At least something notable for sure. But like, I don't know. David Spears would be her next victim, a 43-year-old construction worker who was found with gunshot wounds to his chest on June 1st, 1990. Eileen claims that the situation was nearly identical to the one with Richard, saying that she saw a lead pipe in the backseat of David's truck or in the bed of his truck or something, and that she knew that David was going to get rough with her, so in self-defense, she shot him. However, this is where these killings start to kind of feel weird to me. Mm-hmm. The first one, like I said, I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that it was truly in self-defense. Looking back on his record and what people said about him, that tracks. But David Spears didn't have that record. He was 30 minutes away from his destination where he was expected. He went every single weekend to see his ex-wife and his kids, but he and his ex-wife were rekindling things. He was planning to propose to her again. And it was his daughter's birthday, and he had a bunch of cash for her to take as a present, and like they were expecting him to be there.
That seems like a good way to rekindle things with your ex.
Prostitute?
Stopping by and picking up a prostitute on the way.
So I think, and a lot of people think, it's not just me, that it's more likely that she was hitchhiking and he picked her up hitchhiking.
Something she did do that.
She did hitchhike a lot.
Yeah.
And that he offered her a ride, and she tended to dress more like kind of like a mom and not really like a prostitute. She looked really normal.
Many of them do, especially like this was the late 80s.
This was 1990.
1990. Yeah, like around that time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not, prostitution really shifted in order to continue because,
yeah.
I mean, with the exception of certain areas and certain times, people still think
they're not on the corner.
Yeah. People still think that they're like, you know, this is like Pretty Woman and they're out on the corner and they're thigh high boots and skimpy little clothes. This is not, it happens right under our noses.
Right.
And nobody realizes.
Right. So I don't think that he really thought that she was. Gotcha.
Okay. I'm sorry what I said. He was not.
Stop.
Possibly. Maybe not.
However, it is a weird and out of character, but when his body was found, he was naked and there was an empty condom wrapper in the car.
Oh.
It's not really her MO to undress or change any of her victims, but some people think that she staged it because he still had a baseball hat on.
Mm. So it's questionable.
It's very weird, but it was very out of character for David.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. People are weird. People do strange things. He could have picked her up to solicit. He could have just picked her up as a hitchhiker. We won't know. But it's honestly believed that most of the rest of her victims weren't going to hurt her.
Yeah.
One or two maybe said something. I think the reality, my personal opinion, is that she got spooked on these drives with these men. And because of her history, one wrong turn. Look at her weird. And she's going to protect herself. Okay. Not to mention, she's robbing these men as soon as she's done with them.
Yeah, I was going to say, how much is it?
It's both.
That she's spooked and just over it, if you will.
Right.
And how much is it that she figured out, well, I can get more by killing them and robbing them than I would.
I think that's part of it, too.
Prostituting.
It's so confusing because there's so many different possible motives and derivatives as to why we're here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I do just want to say I don't think that most of these men did not hurt her.
Yeah.
So they didn't deserve to die like this, despite,
no,
you know, it's just horrible. So her next victim was a man named Charles. He was 40. He was discovered in Pasco County. He was a part-time rodeo worker and had been shot 9 times in the chest and stomach.
That's excessive.
Yes. Most of them had been shot like 6, 9. We'll see. Troy was found in Marion County, 50-year-old salesman less than a week after he was reported missing. They found his body. He was found with 2 gunshots to the torso as his cause of death. Another man named Charles Humphreys, was a retired Air Force major, police chief, and Florida child abuse investigator.
Lovely.
Yes. He was found dead in Marion County on September 12, 1990, fully clothed with multiple gunshot wounds to the head and torso. His car was found later in Suwanee County. Say that 5 times fast.
Suwanee.
That one, people think that he was kind of roughing her up because he had some weird views. I don't know. Peter was 65 years old, and he was on his way to New Jersey in the summer of 1990. His car was found in Orange Springs in July of 1990, but his body was never found. However, witnesses do see 2 women in the car in Orange Springs. When those women talk to police, they give a description, and it is very, 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 very close to Ty and Lee.
Oh, so
Ty was definitely in the cars.
Okay.
And Walter was found partially disrobed. He was 62, and he was found November 19th in 1990 in a remote part of Dixie County. He had been shot 4 times in the back of the head, which is different. Everybody else was shot in the front. He was shot in the back of the head. And his car was found 5 days later in Brevard County. She was taking anything of value from them, mm-hmm. taking it home to Ty. They were pawning it and taking mm-hmm. their cars for a few days before dumping their cars. They didn't keep the cars for very long,
mm-hmm.
But she was just coming home with all the stuff and with new cars, and Ty was not asking questions, apparently, even though she had already told her that she had killed somebody before. So I'll just let you think what you will about that.
Okay. And at least one of these, we have an eyewitness who saw
Ty in the car.
A second woman in the car that is described very much as what Ty looks like. Okay, interesting.
Yes. One quote from documentary maker Nick Broomfeld, who we'll talk a lot about later. He spent a lot of time with Eileen after her trial and before her trial. And he said, quote, "People painted Eileen as a monster, which she was not. She was also not a serial killer. Eileen neither planned her crimes, stalked her victims, or took any pleasure from what she did." In his documentaries, he often acknowledged the mental state of Eileen, and we'll talk a little bit more about his opinion later. But, I mean, statistically, like, by definition, she is a serial killer. He just means that she's not, like,
it's planning different.
It, you know?
Yeah.
These men did absolutely not deserve to die for their situations with Eileen.
No.
Most of them, anyway. 100% this was loss of life that was unnecessary and horrible. I mean, it's just so sad, especially when these men were hardworking men. They were just trying to be good citizens and pick up somebody. A lot of people said she looked like a woman on the side of the road who'd run out of gas. Like, she looked like she needed help.
Yeah, especially if at some point Ty was with her.
Well, we don't know if Ty was with her at the time of the crimes. We just know that Ty was seen later in the car.
I know, but, like, that's kind of where I'm going with that, is, like, if they were together and then any of these men, like, picked them both up,
mm-hmm.
but then later, you know, like, gave them a ride, it, like, builds that sense of trust.
And, right.
Like, I'm just giving you a ride. I'm trying to be a nice guy. I'm trying to help. I mean, who knows? And that's just it, is, like you said, and I talked about, prostitution doesn't always look like prostitution. So these guys very much could have just been stopping to give them a ride.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the one guy that you went into more detail with that was on his way to sit, what was his name? David. So who knows? You know, there's also guys that wouldn't be ballsy enough to stop and knowingly stop and pick up a prostitute. But if the opportunity arose, like, once he stops thinking, I'm giving you a ride,
mm-hmm.
and then she offers, who knows? Like,
right,
when faced
we have no idea.
With the opportunity in that sense, who knows?
Yeah, it's a tricky, tricky situation, and it's just horrible.
But it kind of seems to me like there's a good chance that it wasn't under the pretense of prostitution at that point.
Yeah.
Like, once she was well on this pattern.
Yes. I think that, you know, I have so many different, there's so many different options, but it could very much be that she just had a penchant for killing once she did it the first time. And when she saw these opportunities to rob them, she took it. That's what she'll say later. I'm going to show you a clip of her the day before her execution where she changes her story a little bit. So we'll talk about it in a few.
Okay.
In Florida, as we've talked about a couple weeks ago, you have to be fingerprinted when you're pawning things.
Mm-hmm.
So when the police were looking for Richard Mallory's things, they tracked some things back to a pawn shop, and they found that Eileen's prints had been used. Now, it was under an alias, but she had used this alias before, and when the police were able to track it down, they were able to say, okay, it's actually, her real name is Eileen. They put out a sketch based on what the witnesses who had seen them driving the car said, and the cops started asking all the right questions. They were asking questions to Ty's family. They were outside their homes, and Ty turned on Eileen really quickly, recording their phone calls and turning all their phone calls into police. And eventually, Lee was tracked down to a biker bar called The Last Resort. At this point in her life, Eileen was pretty much drunk all the time. And when the cops found her, she was slumped in. Somebody had taken an old car seat out of a car and put it outside the bar, and she was slumped over in that chair. And they basically were like, you can just sleep it off. And they just let her sleep it off all night. And then they arrested her at the bar in the morning.
Wow.
Yep. When she gets into the station, she sits down and she sobs through a confession, and she tells them that she killed all these men in self-defense. It's important to note that her story will change several times over the coming years, but I believe that the truth is somewhere in the extremes. In between, somewhere in her stories is the truth. I don't think that she's hiding something bigger. I don't think that she's hiding a secret desire. She's not getting off on these killings in any sort of way.
Yeah.
I think it started as self-defense, but also she was robbing to keep Ty happy. Maybe she just found she had the compulsion. Unfortunately, we'll never truly know other than what she says. And it's hard to believe exactly what she says when there's signs pointing every other direction.
Right, right.
Eileen was charged with first-degree murder of Richard Mallory, armed robbery with a firearm or a deadly weapon, and with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Prosecutors argued that she'd qualified for the death penalty, and this is the only murder charge that she actually goes to trial for. Prosecution uses videotaped confession of when she comes into the police station for the first time as the pinnacle of their case, and they're able to introduce evidence related to her other charges, because she is charged with the other murders. It's the only case that she'll go to trial for. They were able to bring in her other murder charges as evidence based on a law at the time in Florida called the Williams Rule, which allows evidence related to collateral crimes to be admitted into evidence if it shows motive.
Gotcha.
It can show motive, intent, knowledge, lack of mistake sort of thing. It can show, that was the word in the statute, lack of mistake.
Yeah.
I don't, that's interesting. I guess it just means like it wasn't an accident the first time.
Yeah, just to show, to prove that it wasn't an accident or a mistake.
Yeah. I just thought it was a fun little phrase they threw in there.
You didn't mistakenly kill these people when you pointed a gun at them and fired 6 to 9 times.
Right. Interestingly enough, this Williams rule wasn't applied to her defense team. They were not allowed to bring in the situation, Richard's past crimes. I don't know if they weren't allowed to bring it in or if they even brought it up. But either way, it didn't come out until to the public until after the trial or even closer to the appeals. It came out late.
Well, that kind of makes sense to me because a lot of rules like that in law tends to lean in favor of prosecution.
Yes.
So that makes sense.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I mean.
She had a public defender who definitely did a good job at his first trial. Not going to lie to you. He seemed like a level-headed guy from what I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
Against his wishes, she did testify. However, she really didn't answer a whole lot. She pled the fifth a lot. She repeated her claim of self-defense, and she became agitated and angry during cross-examination. She was the only witness that the defense brought. The defense team also brought up the fact that soon after her arrest, three detectives on the case, as well as Ty, talked to the media and sold their stories and signed contracts for lots and lots of money.
Insert my eye roll.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about the penalty phase a little bit here. Like I said, this was a capital murder case. The prosecution went for the death penalty. And the jury talked about the different factors going into the death penalty, right? The aggravating circumstances that lead it to be a death penalty case. And they found, with a vote to 12-0, a unanimous vote, that there were five aggravating circumstances and only one mitigating factor. The five circumstances were that Eileen had a previous felony conviction involving the threat of violence. She had committed murder during the commission of a robbery. The murder was committed in order to avoid arrest. The murder was heinous, atrocious, or cruel. And they said that the murder was cold, calculated, and premeditated. The murder of Richard Mallory. The only mitigating factor was that she suffered from borderline personality disorder. So basically, they decided that she knew the difference between right and wrong. And between all of these factors, she was unfortunately, but she was given the death penalty.
Yeah, which the premeditation doesn't seem right in that particular case. But yes. Given the other cases or the other killings, it feels like that's okay. Does right. that make sense? I don't know.
It's a weird situation. I don't necessarily agree with the premeditated with this one. Also, I should clarify, whenever we talk about the death penalty, I do this. I've noticed this. I always go, unfortunately, they were given the death penalty. And that makes me feel like, so I was like, does that make me sound like I'm anti-murderer? Like, I'm okay with them living? And that's not what I'm saying. I'm just like, I don't know. It's just a weird
death. Well, you've shared that you're not a fan of the death penalty.
I'm not. I don't know. The death penalty makes me feel weird. So I say unfortunately when I don't necessarily know how I feel.
I've said how I feel about it, which is just I'm in the middle. Like, I'm not totally against it, but I think it's been handed out a little too often.
A little willy-nilly.
Yeah. So I understand her getting the death penalty when you look at all the cases. But if it was just based on this one, the first it killing. Was,
yeah.
But you said that they were allowed to bring in some information from the other killings. Yeah. So that does make sense. If none of those were allowed to be entered into evidence, then I would say it doesn't make sense. But because they were,
right,
it makes sense.
I'm really honestly upset that they were allowed to be admitted because it's such a double standard in other cases. I mean, each case is state by state, obviously, but I just always go back to the staircase where they weren't allowed to bring in the fact that his first, like, he had had a friend that had also died on a staircase,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't bring that into evidence. Or no, they did bring that into evidence, and they shouldn't have been allowed to. Like, yeah. It's just confusing to me, the hearsay rules that just seem to go out the window sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. We've talked about it before, that sometimes the way the court does things to save time and money,
yes.
and everything, and it seems kind of callous. I mean, so in all honesty, I feel like she should have been tried separately for...
Oh, she was. She was going to be tried separately for all of them.
Okay, but then you said that's the only one she went to trial.
It is. She ends up taking deals.
Deals. Okay, gotcha. Yeah, in that case, if they were tried separately...
Yeah, then why were they allowed in?
Why were they allowed in?
Because apparently they showed lack of mistake, but like at the same time, I don't think it was necessary.
Yeah.
I don't know what I wanted them to do. She needed to be in jail. She had killed seven people. She's a serial killer.
Yeah.
She was going to continue to hurt other people.
Yeah.
She was escalating. It was happening.
Yeah.
I don't ever want it to come out that that's not how I feel. That is how, like, why she had killed seven people. People who were trying to help her.
Yeah.
But, like, She's not a process killer. She doesn't enjoy killing. She says later, I'm in the Robin biz.
Sorry.
No, that's what she says.
I know.
So I know. It's just a weird situation. And I think this is where I'm like, the death penalty? Really? Really? Like, let's maybe get the woman some help. She's been raped her entire life. And like, this is the other thing too. If you have never heard of this case, you've never seen clips of her, I highly recommend watching her talk.
Mm-hmm.
And you can
That's
just...
That's why I laughed when you said that, because I could picture her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just heartbreaking to see this woman and you're just like, nobody helped you.
Yeah.
You were like so far left behind by society.
Yes.
And I will say, I did a lot of research on like forums, which I don't normally do. I was on like Reddit a lot, like on the true crime pages, trying to see how people felt about it because it's so conflicting and I wasn't sure how I felt about it. And it is, I would say, like a 75-25 split. Like 75% of people are like, this woman was left behind. She was hurting. She killed a bunch of people, but it's not like she's Jeffrey Dahmer.
No, but the one thing I will say, I don't know how I feel about death penalty versus like life in prison, but I definitely think that she needed to be either in prison or at least institutionalized.
Yes, she should not have been free.
The reason that I say that is because you said borderline personality disorder. So for anybody that doesn't know what that is, definitely look it up. But it's not something that is easily treatable. It's mm-hmm. not, you know, it's not something that can be medicated. It's something that it's a personality disorder that once it's set in adulthood, it's extremely difficult.
Yes.
To change or get them to stop reacting in right. this way. So honestly, that being said, I can see how the first murder was probably out of protecting herself mm-hmm. or self-defense. And thereafter, it just being this is what I do now. This is how I react. Because
yeah.
based on what I know about borderline personality disorder, that tends to be a pattern. Like, they blow up about something. Like you said, she was quick. Her temper mm-hmm. was very volatile. She was quick to get angry, quick to lash out. That is very common with borderline personality disorder. I mean, obviously, you can have that diagnosis and not be that extreme. I mean, it's a spectrum, just like any mental health mm-hmm. disorder. But I don't know that she would have ever been able to get the kind of help that where she could like go back out into the world.
Oh, and no. Yeah.
Live a normal life and stuff.
Like I absolutely. That was all very relevant to this. I mean,
yeah. Yeah.
It's just such a complicated, and like I said, it's controversial. Like, I don't, it's so hard to look at it and be like, you're a horrible person. And like, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Don't kill people. Oh my gosh. But at the same time, this is one of those cases where it just hurts my heart. I think it might be because like we're women and knowing that this is the life that she led, that she was raped and abused and from such yeah. a young age, her whole life. And then I can see it's just so.
Well, we kind of talked about that when I covered serial killer, the Cleveland Strangler, yeah. Anthony Soul. He had a horrible upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, his siblings grew up in the same house and some of them had it just as rough as he did. And they did not become serial killers. It is absolutely not to excuse what they end up doing. But like, you feel for them, like
right.
what chance do you even have to have a normal life?
Yeah. And it just because of how she lived as a drifter and as a prostitute, that abuse continued her entire life. That's all she yes. knew.
Yeah.
And it's just so, and like I said, it's 75-25 of people who are like, so not compassionate isn't the right word. I don't know. I really recommend watching some interviews with her so you can kind of see what I'm talking about. If you look in her eyes, if you have any soul and you look in her eyes and you just, well, that, I don't mean that. I just mean like with empathy, if you look at her, you can just see that this woman needs help.
So what I was going to say is that I think and this may come as no shock to anybody that's a regular listener and to you, that I actually don't have that much of a problem talking about taboos.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why it's taboo. This is such a messy area. Why is it taboo to say, like, why does it have to be all or nothing?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Just because you have compassion or empathy towards somebody that was abused, raped, you know, had to live this terrible yeah. life and ended up making horrible, horrible decisions, obviously, because of it, doesn't take away, in my mind, it doesn't take away my compassion and empathy for the victims and their families.
Yes.
This is just a horrific, sad, sad yes. story.
And you know what? I'm really glad you said that. That was very well worded. I agree with you. I do hate that I feel like a lot of times I have to mitigate how I'm talking and like monitor what I'm saying. Because mm-hmm. I'm very concerned about how people are going to think. But you're right. Yes, it does not need to be one way or the other. I agree with you.
And I think that's why we've had a couple cases recently where we talk about like the victims not being Susie Sunshine and they weren't the best people. Does that mean that they deserved what happened to them? Absolutely not.
Right.
Like people turn life into like black and or like moral issues into black and white things. And I just don't get it.
I agree.
Because life is not like that. Life is a lot yeah. of gray. There's a lot of gray
and
in life.
This case is so gray.
And you
gray.
Can absolutely have some compassion for both sides and say it's terrible that this person grew up this way, this person mm-hmm. had to live this life or chose to live that life based on the trauma that they already had. And their life is so sad, but it's also so sad that then they turn around and that affected what they went through, affected all these other people
yeah.
and their families. And it's just a domino effect.
Yeah.
And it's just,
it is
sad all around in my mind.
It is sad. I didn't realize how sad this case was when I started researching it. It has been really heavy the last 2 weeks to learn all about this, and it's been really hard, honestly.
It is. This is
a case that I've had nightmares about, not gonna lie to you. Like I have dreamt about it, and it's
this is why I was so happy to hear that you were gonna be doing it when I saw this was yeah. the case that yeah. was voted on.
Alicia was like, yes, you can do that because I don't want to.
I
and
do
I was
not
like,
want
why?
To
why don't you want to?
No thank you. Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's why
I understand why.
Yeah, I knew. I mean, I have forgotten a lot of the details to mm-hmm. it because it's been a long time since I've seen the movie or watched a documentary or anything about her. But yeah, it's just a sad.
Yeah, it is.
Sad story.
And it's going to get sadder for just a minute.
Yep.
Because let's talk about what happens after her trial for Richard Mallory. Because I didn't know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
In jail. Should say prison, it's not jail. Eileen is written to by a woman named Arlene. Confusing, so I'm gonna call Eileen Lee.
Okay.
Arlene says that she had a dream that she was supposed to write to Lee and that she was being told by God to take care of her. So she does. She becomes friends with Lee, writing every day, exchanging poetry, and got so close that she actually legally adopted Lee and Lee changes her last name and everything.
Oh, wow. Yes. I didn't know that.
Yes. She was adopted as an adult by this woman. And Arlene hired an attorney to do all of the adoptions and the name changes. And he somehow also becomes like her agent. I didn't know that they tested for how to be an agent on the bar exam. But this attorney is the weirdest MF-er I have ever seen. He's the weirdest attorney I have ever seen. I've known some oddballs. He is weird. I don't know how this man passed the bar. Like, I have watched so many clips and interviews and videos of him, and he's just odd.
Wait, is this still in Florida?
Yes.
He's Florida attorney man.
He's Florida attorney man. He created a stuffed version of his childhood imaginary friend, and it is terrifying.
What?
Oh, yeah, it's terrifying. He had it on his front porch to keep the homeless away. He was a weird guy. He looks a little bit like that guy in the alien documentaries on the History Channel.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that guy? A little bit. He looks a little bit like that. So just picture that. Anyway, Arlene swore up and down that she wasn't motivated by money or movie deals and that she was purely motivated by good Christian intention and her love for Aileen. She even told a story about how she was in some sort of accident. I think it may have been horse related. I don't know why I get that impression. She just said accident. But she said something about being kicked. It was livestock related.
Okay.
I don't know. She was in an accident. And she said that the doctor said she was going to die, but that her love for Lee poured through her body and she knew that she had to be there for Lee. And so she lived because of her love for Lee. And the doctors agree with her that that's why she lived.
She says that the doctors agree with her.
Yes, she says the doctors agree with her.
Okay.
She's telling all of this to Nick Bloomfield, who does a lot of these docuseries. And Lee knew him. He did, I would say, the most unbiased interviews with her. That's what I'll say. And I think that he has a good opinion. I read that one quote from him earlier. You know, he knew her as much as you could know her.
Yes.
And Aileen really did care for Arlene. She loved having someone take care of her. She declared herself a born-again Christian. She had found God. What Lee didn't know was that Arlene was profiting off of Lee's story. She was well-documented by the local news, and she wouldn't talk to private documentary makers without a hefty price tag. She was doing this to pay herself and to pay Steven, the attorney who had taken over Lee's other trials. Now, I mean this with all respect for weirdos and oddballs, because I've met some weird people and they're great. But this weirdo is not capable of handling a capital murder trial. And he knew that.
Well, it's not that attorneys cannot dabble in other areas that are
some attorneys think they can do
everything. Not their specialty.
Yeah.
But they shouldn't.
I really don't like calling this guy an attorney, to be honest with you. It really bothers me. But like,
did he normally do criminal law, or did he?
I have no idea. I don't think this man did much of anything.
Oh, wow. Okay.
He, like I said, they knew he couldn't do this, and they just wanted to make some money, I think, in my opinion. It is also my opinion, and the opinion of others, that they encouraged Lee's no contest pleas and guilty pleas to the other murders because he knew that he couldn't handle the trial.
Right.
On top of that, she wanted to get right with God, according to her, and come clean is what she wanted to do. Now, I think that this is important because if she had had a competent attorney handling her other cases, and any of her other cases had been declared self-defense cases, then that, because the other cases were allowed as evidence into her first trial, that could have affected everything. They could have gone back and redone it, especially because when it's a capital case, you automatically get an appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So they were already going to appeal her Richard Mallory case. If she had gotten a not guilty verdict with another case, they could have used that. I'm not saying that that's what should have occurred, but the only reason I'm saying that is it is so important that she was taken advantage of again by these people that it completely could have changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
She killed these men. Just make your own opinion about it. This is what we're giving you. I'm just giving you the reality.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm like thinking, how do I phrase that without, like, I mean, the likelihood of her appeal going through.
Oh, very slim to none.
Or very slim to none anyway.
But the likelihood that she would get a not guilty
deal. Yeah, it just.
It's all very messy. But I just, the reason I'm saying this is because this instance of this guy choosing to do this and saying I can handle it, in law, those decisions can make or break it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. From a legal standpoint, it's interesting to me think about how things could have changed.
Yeah.
I still think she should go to jail and do her time. I'm not saying anything different. I just, it could have been different. Not saying it should have been, but it could have been. She pled no guilty or no contest to all the other murders. And she was sentenced to the death penalty, again, for Richard Mallory. She was put to death in October of 2002 in the state of Florida. Nick Blumenfeld interviewed Eileen the day before she was put to death and the day of her execution. The day before, he does this interview with her, and I'm going to show it to you. It is terrifying to me. He says after, he really struggles with the fact that she passed the psychological exam that you have to pass before you could be executed. You have to pass a psych eval saying that you understand why you're being executed and you understand the concept of the death penalty and be end of death.
Mm-hmm.
She had passed that the day before or earlier in the day. And then seeing the state that she's in, he was like, I think it's in the video that I'm going to show you. He says, I don't understand what she would have had to have done to have failed it. Okay.
So gotcha.
I'm going to play this for you. Just tell me what you see in her eyes.
Let them know that I know that the cops knew who I was after Richard Mallory. I left prints everywhere and they covered it up. And let me arrest those guys to turn me into a serial killer. I know they did because I was no professional. Yeah, I'm ready to go. They had the intercom on in the room and they kept lying that it wasn't on. And they were using sonic pressure on my head since 1997. They're trying to make it look like I was crazy at all times, rig up the room with torture. If I said anything about their whole plan was to try to make it look like I was totally crazy. And so nobody would believe anything I had to say about anything.
Her eyes are black in these videos. Like, do you see what I'm talking about? She is not in a good mental state.
Well, she's talking about using sonic pressure.
Yeah.
On her since 19. Like.
Right. Right.
It reminds me of a client. Or, I'm sorry, not a client. They wanted to be a client of ours. They wanted to sue. They had a whole backstory. And I took their information initially. And then they went into how. Because they're all watching. They're all watching. Every time you walk into a supermarket, every time you walk into a store, they're reading your brainwaves.
I do remember this now. Yeah.
What?
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 Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how somebody could be considered, you know.
Right.
Of sound mind. I'll put it that way.
So the reason that this case was even on my radar was because I saw the following video, which is taken the day of her execution. She calls Nick Blumenfeld and she says, I want you to come down and I want to talk to you. And this is what she says the day of her execution.
Okay, I cannot go in the execution chamber and die in the execution chamber as a liar. And I cannot go in the execution chamber and be executed under the devil. I have to come clean and cleanse my spirit in the name of Jesus Christ. So I have to come clean and tell the world
that you killed those men in cold blood.
Yeah, and I got to come clean that I killed those seven men in first degree murder and robbery. As they said, they had it right. A serial killer. Not so much like thrill kill. I was into the robbing biz.
And so like when you met them from the beginning, did you know that you were going to kill them? When they picked you up in their cars?
I pretty much had them selected that they were going to die.
But when you're saying that there was no self-defense, so there was no self-defense.
No, there was no self-defense.
So, all this confusion, and at the end, she gives this confession that there was no self-defense to begin with. And I don't know if I believe her. She doesn't look at Nick when she talks to him in this video. Like when she's confessing and saying she killed him in cold blood.
Yeah, her eyes are very dirty.
They're very dirty. And they weren't the day before when she was talking about it. It was just, you don't know what to think.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre. And so I just want you to know the roller coaster that I went on, because that was the first clip I ever saw of her. And then I start researching and everyone's like, oh, yeah, she was horribly mistreated. These people, like Richard Mallory, definitely raped her. Da, 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 da. And it's just, what do you think? When and she's changed her story. She's done this, you know, so many times over the years where she said, self-defense, no self-defense, self-defense, you know.
Mm-hmm. But she's of sound mind.
Right. I don't know. It's so gray.
I don't know what to make of that. I didn't know anything about that.
Really?
Yeah.
So I, like I said, I saw that first and I started researching and I was so confused when the whole time I'm like, what do you mean? I saw her confess to doing this. What do you mean people don't know? But then when you look at it, people are like, no, we have no way. We really don't know.
Yeah. Wild.
Wild.
I'm still processing.
I know. It's a lot.
Yeah.
She called her Tyra, so I guess her name is Tyra. I've heard her say, like, Taria, yeah. Taria. Like, I've heard her name pronounced so many different ways.
It's spelled different.
It's spelled weird.
I mean, I would.
I would have said Tyria based on the way it's spelled.
Yeah.
But I just called her Ty because I knew.
Wild.
Right? Like, what do you think? I mean, what do you think?
I don't know what to think other than what I said. Is that it just feels like this is just a sad story all around. Nobody's a winner.
Can I say something shocking?
Except for the a-holes that took advantage.
The thing that I'm going to say that's shocking is she seems genuinely remorseful in that clip. She's like, yeah, I'm really sorry. I think about their families. I think, like, what I lost. Like, I feel bad. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that given her state of mind and her...
I guess you're right.
Lack of healthy mental state.
Yeah.
She does. If I compared her to, like, the average person, I would say...
No.
It didn't come across with a whole lot of feeling. But given that she's not really probably capable of having, like, expressing yeah. that much emotion, then
because
yes.
a lot of psychologists who have examined the case think that she fits the profile of a psychopath.
Yeah.
But she was officially, through the court process, given borderline personality disorder. And I believe one other. I'm not sure what the other one was.
Yeah.
The borderline is the one that stuck out to me the most. So, yeah. Horrible case. I feel bad for the families. I feel bad for Peter's family the most because they never got his body back. And I always hate that in true yeah. crime because it just feels so incomplete. And I hope that that his family was able to find closure despite that.
Yeah.
Them's the breaks. That's the case. I told you it was going to be a chatty one.
No, that's fine. I'm always fine with chatty. I just feel icky and I don't have a lot of, and I'm right up on my mic. No, I just feel.
I feel like no matter what I.
Icky. Yeah. Like, I don't know some of that stuff that happened after, like after she gets caught and stuff, I wasn't aware of. Because, you know, a lot of series and stuff don't really, they just tell you, oh, she was
yeah
convicted of this and that's it. That's all you hear.
There's a documentary called Eileen Wuornos, The Selling of a Serial Killer. And that one was really eye-opening about yeah. all the stuff that happens after.
I kind of question, if you look at that video that you just showed me mm-hmm. with her changing her story and saying, I need to come clean before I'm executed. If you look at it through like a skeptical lens of, okay, well, why would she, if she's not being honest there, why would she, you know, if,
right.
if her saying that it was not self-defense is not honest, why would she lie about that at that point? Because I think yeah. it's easy to say, oh, well, she had no reason to lie. She was being executed. So a lot of people would believe that, take it at face value.
Right.
But I don't necessarily think that, especially given the fact that she, what I, this may be an unpopular opinion, but I kind of question if it's linked to her finding faith.
Right. I mean, it could definitely be. It could be that somebody told her, hey, we're going to pay this person a lot of money if you tell them this before you go. And she feels like she needs to take care of the people around her. It could be a lot of things.
I
mean,
it could be a lot of things. I'm just saying, outside of like a conspiracy where people are telling her, I could see her feeling like, I need to just come clean and take responsibility and not of my actions.
Right, regardless.
Regardless of what other people did or what I was afraid they were going to do or whatever.
Right. But the thing,
I don't know.
My thing is, that's confusing to me is that she had no reason to say it was self-defense if it wasn't once she was convicted for Richard Mallory. Because she had said from the minute she sat down in the police station, put me in the electric chair, I'm here to confess and fry. Like, you can kill me for what I've done. I killed these men. Yeah. So she was ready to be executed from day one. She was on, like, she never fought that.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, a normal amount, like everybody does, but general consensus through her entire trial process and in her, you know, time in custody in jail, she was comfortable with them killing her because she felt like she knew what she had done. So there was no reason for her to say it was self-defense to try and get off. I think she was telling the truth for part of it. And then it just, that was, I think that was her truth, honestly.
Yeah.
I think in her head, she felt that by keeping herself safe and killing these men, she was A, keeping other people safe, and B, just proactive self-defense, I think is what she convinced herself of, despite the fact that most of these men were not going to hurt her. Not all. There are a couple that people were pretty sure that they were going to, but we don't know, and I don't want to sully victims' names in the sake of conspiracy, so.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah,
that's one of those cases that leaves you like, ugh.
Yeah,
with your hands out, going, what? Because we'll never know the full story.
Nope.
Because who knows if she even knows the full story?
I don't think
she was drunk and high and has mental health issues.
Right. I don't think she does either.
Yeah. Sad.
Yep.
But you did a good job condensing it.
Thank you.
Because I know that definitely could have been a two-parter.
It could have been. It's a really long case. But we did so many two-parters in March. We didn't want to do any two-parters for a minute. So I condensed it. I hope I did an okay job. I hope you're not confused. I mean, we're all confused with this one.
Yes.
Well, if you made it this far into the episode, please leave us a shrug emoji.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Shrug.
I don't know. I'm doing my best to figure out this case, and I think the answer is I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yep, let the silence hang. That's how I feel. I am happy to put this to bed, though, because this was a lot. I had dreams about getting shot in a car. It was not fun.
Ew.
Yeah, I'm ready to be done. So, bye, Eileen. We'll talk to you guys next week, hopefully with something a little bit more definitive, not in the gray area.
Hopefully.
I was going to say, what's your next case? You know.
I have an idea of what my next case is. I started the research, but we'll see.
All right. Well, I'll leave the ball in Alicia's court until next Thursday. We'll talk to you guys later.
Till next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, guys. Find us on Instagram and TikTok at Burden of Proof Pod and email us at burdenofproofpod@gmail.com.